As Scott pointed out, finding meteorites, these little balls of rock from outer space, is key to understanding what the Kuiper Belt is actually made of. Meteor strikes are relatively common. They happen 5 to 10 times a year. But the difficulty isn't necessarily finding these rocks here on Earth. It's actually trying to figure out where they came from, as Philip Bland from Curtin University has discovered. He set up Desert Fireball to tackle this problem and told Georgia Mills how it worked.
It's a project where we've put out lots of little kind of observatories across Australia, and they look at the whole sky and image everything that comes through the atmosphere. And what we do then is we're able to triangulate the orientation of anything coming through, track it back to where it comes from in the solar system, and forward if it lands to where it lands. We get its orbit and we get a full position.
And are you also trying to use the great power of the masses to help in this project?
Yes, we are. So if you see a fireball, you can pull out your phone and hold it up to the sky, click on where it started, where it ended, the colour. You can log all of this stuff and then blip us that information. And that also helps us triangulate it. If we get enough data and we can tell you your fireball came from out beyond Mars and hit the top of the atmosphere at 20 kilometres a second.
I guess it's people's first instinct anyway when they see something incredible in the skies. Get your phone out.
Get your phone out, exactly. So this actually gives you a scientific purpose to get your phone out.
Anyone taking meteorite selfies?
Well, we've not actually had that yet.
When you get this data from all your observatories and maybe from people as well, what do you do? How do you go and find the asteroid?
That's the hard part. So we build this wind model, and then you head out in the middle of nowhere with a team of 6-7 people, and you've just got to be very optimistic and perky for a week and try and keep them going while you don't find it, until in the end hopefully you do, and then you will, you know, have a bottle of wine or several.
And I believe you've got something you have found with you here.
This is a meteorite. This was the first one we found. This kind of proved that it worked.
It looks and feels a bit like a sort of shiny lump of coal. You mentioned that this little guy, does he have a name?
Yep, this is Bunbura Rock Hole. The meteorites normally get named for the nearest post office. Needless to say, nearest post office, I think about 1,000 kilometres away from where this was found, so it doesn't really narrow it down. Then you get named for the nearest topographic feature. Now, again, I'd encourage people to take a look at the Nullarbor. There's no topography, so from that point of view as well, it's a complete disaster.
You just end up naming them all desert.
Well, yeah, I mean, the nearest thing on the map with any name was 40 kilometres away, which was a kind of a little sinkhole in the limestone. And that's the only thing with any name, which is kind of bonkers, yeah.
Once you have this rock and you've used your tracking to work out where it's come from, what do you do with it once you find it?
You know, we'll look at the isotopic composition, the chemistry. We'll use microscopy. We'll do kind of CT scans of the thing. So there's a ton of analyses that we can do to kind of build up a picture of its whole history. This one was, so the exciting thing about this, I guess there's a few things. This was, so we got an orbit for this. And the orbit was very, very weird. The orbit is actually almost the same as Earth's orbit. So pretty much the whole orbit for this one is interior of the Earth's orbit. It doesn't go anywhere near the asteroid belt. And that's bizarre. The composition of the thing is also really weird. So the best we can tell is that this might be, it's not like a dead ringer for the precursor material that went in to make the Earth. This sort of rock is part of that story. So we're trying to work out, you know, what the precursor was that the Earth got built from. And this helped us get a little bit closer to that. So having the orbit and the rock were really, really useful for that.
What's the furthest you've ever got anything from?
The furthest thing I've never held it in my hand, but it was material from the Stardust mission. I was lucky enough to be part of the preliminary analysis team for the Stardust mission, and the goal in that mission, which was very successful, was to bring back dust from Comet Vilt 2. And the spacecraft flew through the tail of the comet, got pretty close actually, and got pretty battered. But then put that in a capsule, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and then a whole bunch of researchers from around the world kind of joined together to analyze it. It was fantastic. So this was when I was back in the UK, and I was waiting for my samples, and I was expecting some very official NASA kind of delivery man, kind of man in black type situation, you know, with a briefcase locked to his wrist, and it came in a DHL padded envelope.
No expense spared.
No, but still very, very cool to get samples of a comet. And a student of mine, Penny Vozniakovich, did an amazing job analysing that material, and people at Natural History Museum as well. Colleagues of mine did a wonderful job analysing it and being part of that whole process with other researchers. An incredible amount of information has come out. It's been a really successful mission.
And this was out from as far as the Kuiper Belt. Would any specimens from the Kuiper Belt actually fall to Earth? Is that something you're looking for?
We go through streams of comet debris on a regular cycle, which are meteor streams. Most of that stuff is dust, which means that it'll almost all burn up in the atmosphere really high up. But some of it is chunkier. And there's one stream in particular, the Geminids. It's a comet that's been cooked up a lot by many close approaches to the sun. So it's certainly not in as good shape as it was originally. But what that's done is the material is denser now, and it looks like some of that should be able to make it to the Earth's surface. So my kind of holy grail, you know, if we're ever going to find anything, would be that we'd see something come in. We'd put those images together, we'd calculate its orbit. Its orbit would match one of these Geminid meteors, and we'd work out that it had landed, and we'd go and pick it up. And that would be absolutely incredible. It wouldn't be nearly as pristine as some of the others, but technically that's possible.
Best case scenario, what could you learn from a meteorite that had come all that way?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I mean, best case scenario, you know, I got into planetary science and studying meteorites because as a geologist, it felt like a lot of the things in geology, you know, we'd worked out pretty well. You know, we know the kind of grand unifying theory for geology, plate tectonics, and it's been kind of a case of putting the finishing touches to that, really. But in terms of what happened before planets got made, or how we made planets, or why the Earth has the composition that it does, we really have very little idea. So if you ask someone, okay, how do you make terrestrial planets? How do you get a planet that's got a nice mix of rock and ice and water and organic material? Well, no one knows. You know, there's dozens of different options. And I found that really, really exciting, you know, as kind of a young researcher. So that's why I got into it. So in the best possible case, you know, we'd work out why we have terrestrial planets in the inner solar system, why that happened. And that would be quite exciting to know that.
Curtin's Philip Band, and Philip is right.